the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Monahan speak with Goulburn-based British poet Andrew Moss about his life and work. Boston boy, man, I'm over black. Too real crazy and known for that. Talk about peace, but you owe me that. Man, I'm not real like that. Andrew Moss is a writer currently based in Goulburn, whose poetry has been featured in the Best New British and Irish Poets Anthology 2019-21 from the Black Spring Press Group, Poetry for the Planet, an anthology of imagined futures from Litonry Press, and Nambano, an anthology of speculative poetry by BIPOC poets from Sundress Publications. He has 3 recently published books by Rosie Ravelston Press. He is particularly adept in live readings of his poetry, as was evident when we began by asking him to read a signature poem. He selected Saintly Francis.
The poem that I wrote called Saintly Francis was about a Sierra Leonean cleaner that worked at the school where I was teaching in London, at the primary school, and Francis would come along to my classroom with a large novel each afternoon, and we got chatting, and I found out that he was an accountant and he was waiting for his papers so that he could get other work, basically. So this poem is inspired by Francis, and it's called Saintly Francis. Francis sweeps the floors in hope, soaps down dirty walls, knocks gingerly at the head teacher's emerald door before he vacuums her red carpet floor. His life in a vacuum of another type. He waits for his papers from the Home Office whilst we paper over the cracks of the injustice, saying prayers behind his back. Francis, an accountant by trade, counting down his days, waiting for his papers. Abacus beads of perspiration, sweat glistens, drip. I listen in to his tragedy. He explains his narrative in optimistic lilt, lullabies of Sierra Leonean Creole, tones tinged with French accents, where R's and W's collide, waiting for his far from home office papers, paper chained delays. He's a number, numbering the days, made stranger, numbed by delays, waiting for a stamp, approval at a cost. Look, I'm a lord of the mic, and I ain't been lord of the mics.
Can't chat about bars, can't chat about flow, car, man, I've done all of that hype. Let's review the basics. How did Andrew Jeffrey Kwabena Moss, a poet of Anglo-Ghanaian heritage who's lived in the UK, Japan, and now Australia, come to land in Goulburn?
I married an Aussie girl and we met in northwest London. Heather, my wife at the time, she came from Goulburn. So after going to a few other places, I really liked Goulburn. I loved the Federation houses, the very distinctive cathedrals, the sandstone cathedral, the Anglican cathedral there, and the green porphyral Catholic cathedral. Mm-hmm. So that really took my attention. And the fact that even when we visited in, would have been, I can't even think of the month, but there was a frost there and that was familiar. So there was something different and exotic about it, but also something comforting and familiar in that it was similar to the UK in a sense. So I did actually feel at home but not at home at the same time.
I think that whole idea of home but not at home is actually really something that resonates through your whole poetry.
Mm. Yeah, and it's those perspectives of feeling a sense of belonging but also feeling slightly adrift as well.
Mm. I wondered if you could talk briefly about each of the 3 books of poetry that you have coming out.
Yeah, it's a suite of 3 collections, basically. And chronologically speaking, the first collection is called Japan Abandon, which has the subtitle Travels in Japan. And it's very much autobiographical. You could even say autoethnographic, in the sense that I'm looking back to the time when I migrated to Japan. I was there for 2.5 years, and it charts my view landing and in this very foreign culture, and it charts my reactions and my development and becoming more at ease within Japanese culture. So the themes there would be definitely dislocation as I first arrived there, and the theme of home again, and different people's perspectives, especially the Western, the Occidental perspective on the Orient and vice versa. Mm. That fascinated me. And again, it's part of a wider, I suppose, search for Zion, or a place where I would belong. In a way, I went with also the metaphor of earthquakes in terms of initial shocks when I first got there, and the tremors that increased as I stayed there longer, and some of those tremors subsided. And then the aftershocks when I moved back to the UK, and I actually had probably, as I'm sure a lot of listeners will be familiar with that have lived overseas, when you return, of course, you see things through the eyes again of an outsider, so it's kind of double whammy. The second collection is called Manifest O. So obviously play on words with a manifesto. It is political in a sense. It investigates war and peace, and it's split into three sections. The first section is about race and migration, some of it historical, some of it through meeting particular people and experiences. The second part is about housing inequalities, mostly due to race, but also the intersection with class. And the third section is about war, and it's about how colonial subjects, often of colour, have been sidelined from the mainstream narrative. So it's trying to actually reassert that history. And finally, on a much more optimistic note, it ends with peace and a call really for the everyday interactions and peaceful interactions that there are. It's partly inspired by Paul Gilroy, the sociologist, and his view of planetary humanism, and the fact that soon enough, you know, our perspectives will really change in terms of commonality, because of course as we venture further into space, we'll look with that greater sense of perspective that really, irrespective of race and class, we are all together. So that's how the manifesto ends, really. Just a call for hybridity, a call for acceptance, you know, of our differences, basically.
Would you read the subtitle, Manifesto?
Yes, the subtitle there is, it's a manifesto for peace and convivial living.
So I have to tell you, the phrase convivial living with the word manifesto together just delights me. Right. And somehow I feel like maybe that's a bit of you. It's very you. Am I right?
And that's where I feel at home. That's what inspires me. Mm. Just those everyday, seemingly mundane interactions that actually really prove that there's a lot of peace actually in the world, and it's something that should be celebrated and something that we should actually, you know, be inspired by. The third collection, Diaspora Cubed, is about my heritage and my, I suppose, extension of heritage. Now I can add the hyphen and Australian now, to the Anglo and the Ghanaian, and especially as my children get older, I'm looking at their identity as Australians as well. And again, it's an exploration of that. It's a celebration of it, but also it's challenging some of the stereotypes or some of the mindsets that there are. And sometimes, yes, those challenges of coming from different places and negotiating those places. I'm not by no stretch a mathematician, but I got the idea, obviously, the cube idea with the three identities. But yeah. I was reading a book by Binyavanga Wainaina, the Kenyan author who wrote his memoir, One Day I Will Write About This Place. And he had the phrase home squared, which I really liked. I think when he was talking about his mum's heritage being Ugandan and living in Kenya, that sort of dual heritage. But also in that memoir, he really talks about the different expression and perspective of the world through different languages in Kenya, and how those languages really mirror quite deeply entrenched philosophies or ways of looking at the world. So I wanted to explore how we look at the world through those lenses of heritage. So pull out your jeans, get off the street and go do your man proud. Go get a job and don't come out your house.
Mom, look, I don't rate them boys. Before asking Andrew Moss more about the nature of his writing, we asked him to provide us with a couple more examples. He read two poems from Manifesto, one of his recent publications, Misread and Mature Cheddar Gorging.
Misread. The poem is dedicated to the lost civilizations and nations, the dispossessed and misplaced, judged and recovered, pages flicked through and cast aside on dusty bookshelves. Dear reader, where should I begin? As I flick through the pages within, far from the back where the chapters are fat, at the back pages where they're faded and withered, mottled, dog-eared and torn with a jaded tinge, or in the lean, lithe middle, past the pages that giggle, before complications' twisted plots. You have an exotic cover, bound to be published by private press. The blurb speaks of persuasive eccentricity, British brogue, Ghanaian ancestry. History's pages have stolen and enslaved us, historiographies and holocausts stamped in the past. Now I'm scanned by a red glow of fear. Uncertainty classified between Afrofuturistic fiction and post-colonial non-fiction, liminal post-Dewey systems. The illustrations disappointing, only drawn in black and white, ill-fitting fictions, roughly sketched depictions of seldom heard voices. Proofread too many times for sin tax. My cohesion is intact. Across paragraphs and transatlantic pages, I bounce forth and back. A polysemic text, vexed by an old-fashioned reading. Where'd you hear all he from? Where'd you hear all he from? Where? I do not know this Don. Where do you know me from? I'd like to read a poem where I was playing with the idea of the research that came out that the first, well, modern Britons were actually dark-skinned and had blue eyes. So I imagined a dinner party conversation between a history professor and she is either an optician or... Yeah, I think she's an optician. And in the conversation, they're basically discussing this research. So this is called Mature Cheddar Gorging. You black people, Eva the optician quipped, with a sardonic straight face and stiff upper lip, high on white wine, a post-racial mischief of our times, a drink mixed with flirtation and fear in equal parts, at a dinner party of classy white privilege, somewhere in deepest, darkest Somerset, not far from Wells. Offering the cheese platter to Hakim, the lecturer, it was time to make a statement. Cured meats, salami, prosciutto, olives and crackers. What a feast! Hakim eyed up the exotic cheese on offer. There were so many options on the platter. Aged, gouda, gruyere, soft and creamy, epoisse, burrata. The freshest mozzarella, crumbly, goat and feta. A smoked selection, gouda or provolone? Or was he lonely, feeling blue enough for Roquefort or Gorgonzola? Something straightforward. He picked up the red Leicester, caressing it on his cracker. The next selection he lifted up, the cheddar, like a gemologist, with lapidary hesitation, assessing treasure. Hakim held it up for introspection, an encrusted sliver of off-white gold rectangular cheddar. This reminds me of a gem, a horrific hidden history, he beamed. Evidently, all was not quite what it seemed. Smiling at his interlocutor, Ava flapped her eyelids and curtsied, weak at the knees. A discovery made no less on the edge of this very village. It's best to support local industry. You speak in riddles. Then I'll continue. Remember, it was all in the papers. The skeletal remains discovered in the caves, not far from here, in Cheddar Gorge. Eva nodded in encouragement. It was groundbreaking what they unearthed. The Mesolithic skeleton in the British wardrobe. Laughing at the pun let out of the closet, Eva nodded on. Cheddar man, the oldest of us Homo sapiens, quite the man. DNA analysis by modern-day trepanning. The scientist drilled a 2 millimeter diameter hole, extracting a few milligrams of powder from the bone. A toothless wonder, so no enamel oxygen isotope. Eva, do you know what they did? And why they did it? She shook her head in disbelief. Drrr, he teased and mimed a dentist drilling. To get the full genome! The next-gen shotgun sequencing, defining myriad DNA, random fragments across the genome. They created a database and mapped his against the DNA of modern human genomes, you and I. Cheddar Man, the forensics suggest, left Africa and headed to the Middle East, then west to Europe. Our neighbour, he crossed Doggerland. Eva frowned. The ancient land bridge, came the explanation. Again she flapped her eyelids. The old Euro tunnel. Isn't he funny, she thought, thoroughly smitten, that connected continental Europe to Britain. His good looks caused distraction. The original refugee identity crisis, you might say. Get ready for the twist. Licking his lips, pausing before, he crunched the cheddar cracker, gripped in the vice of his thumb and forefinger. Guess what it looked like. I'm not sure, Eva responded. Pale skin, fair hair like me, of course. Sorry to disappoint the pigments of your imagination. Brits developed pale skin much later. Do go on, pressed Eva, dressed in shock. Cheddar Man was black, Hakim announced in bold capitals. The dinner party's heart attacked. The clinking of champagne flutes stopped, frozen, in deafening silence. He had blue eyes and dark to black skin, he uttered triumphantly. Today, Eva, 10% of British ancestry can be linked, they think, to this ancient population. That means about 12 of you here, besides me, of course. Hakim staged a guffaw, spinning around and bowing. Spectacular showman, theatrically at his audience. You're the optician, Eva. Here's one in your eye. You black people. The cheddar superiority complex put to the test. We black people, earlier, didn't you mean?
Where do you know me from? Where do you know me from? Where do you know me from? Where do you know me? I'm going to allow it.
There's lots of ideas in there, and your poetry reads very abundantly. You talked about home, there's futurism, there's a stream probably of Afrofuturism. While you're very mindful of the concept of home, it's also very apparent that there's so much hostility to a lot of people and a lot of ideas in the world that you find yourself in. So, for example, there's a lot of talk of the surveillance state, of inequalities. Do you have no option, in a sense, but to look to concepts beyond local concepts of home?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And certainly Afrofuturism is something that gives hope, those thought experiments, without engaging in the dream and in imagining something better. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can make those breakthroughs. So to me, it's actually something that's tantalizingly close. It can appear to be quite depressing in the sense that, as you mentioned, in many places, you know, there is that surveillance, there is that negativity, yet alongside it often, where you least expect it, there is an amazing sort of optimism and vision that you have. And through writing one of the Afrofuturistic poems, Nyankopoxican breath of fresh air. I have the pleasure of meeting some American poets and getting to know a few of them and just realizing that that sort of, I suppose, geeky idea, I was not alone in that. But it's actually, to me, it's a very close to reality, and it's almost you're summoning something that will happen, I hope, in the future.
Actually, that raises a question of where you might find kinship. Is there a community of poets in the UK? There doesn't seem to be quite the same sort of ideas floating around in Australia. They're certainly in the US, but there's a wide world. I get the sense that you probably listen to British rap, for example.
There are definitely those influences. And again, it's a way of staying back in touch with things as they develop in the UK. Mm. And there was the sense, actually, when I first came, that the UK was really quite advanced in terms of its tolerance due to lots of immigration. And I think geographically, you know, people having through less space to get alongside each other in a faster sort of way. So there was optimism at first. And then, though, with kind of Brexit and some of those ideas, you know, Britain again had the sort of fortress mentality. So I've seen things change. Now, listening to things like grime or rap gives me that pathway to listen to ideas as they're developing. I do read British poets a fair bit, and Black British poets, and, you know, people like Johnny Pitts, who wrote the book Afropean, and Roger Robinson, for example, again, that and their recent book, Home Is Not a Place, I think it is. But they basically go around the periphery of the UK in a red mini, and they find these diasporan African communities. And traditionally, it's the metropole that gets the attention for Black immigration. Yet they've sought the peripheries, and they exist. And that's kind of where I'm from myself. So I find there are all sorts of new sort of explorations that happen. I sort of linked up. I was very lucky to link up with a American, originally Jamaican scholar, Dr. Marva McLean, and she has a group, and we meet on Zoom. There's a British poet, Emily Isabel Marshall. There are some African American poets, Jeffrey Phillip, for example. And we just basically, it's a forum where you share poems, and she calls it the poetics of the global diaspora. She actually Marva met up with a Aboriginal Australian academic, Dr. Marcus Waters. And they wrote a book together. They met at a conference, and Marva's research is with the Maroon community in Jamaica, that breakaway community, that, you know, runaway slaves who essentially set up their own communities much more similar to their West African antecedents. But she met up with Dr. Marcus Waters, and they at this conference, and they co-wrote a book about basically indigenous culture. And what really attracted me, I was sort of following another poet, and she had something published in one of Dr. Marva's newsletters, and I noticed that she said it was, you know, she was connecting Black, Caribbean, European, African, but also including Aboriginal Australia as well. So I really liked that connection that was being made. We have a similar view of the need to amplify, you know, previously marginalised voices.
How do you describe where poetry and history meet?
I've struggled. I've thought about, you know, I studied history at university, and I found that it was not alive. I'm personally not satisfied as a discipline whether history itself actually serves much. You know, it seems like it's a grand statement, but I suppose to me it is just another form of storytelling. I get very frustrated by the fact that it's looked upon somehow as being more objective than that. So to me, I find literature more honest. I don't differentiate history and literature. and creative writing in that sense. So to me, things that are historical in those poems are part of storytelling traditions, and I am, as historians do, I believe, being selective and curating certain threads and focusing on certain aspects, certain stories, and I want to elevate certain stories that I feel are not in a historical or a literate canon, basically. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the poetry is enough for the protest that you're trying to make?
Possibly it is an armchair protest. It depends where you do it. So I think you can reach rather than preach through doing it. And there's something about how memorable the lyricism might be in terms of perhaps implanting an idea. And I think there's something quite spiritual about it as well. There's something prayerful. But in terms of how you apply it, that's very much open to debate. If people join together and collaborate and gain the awareness of other people, then I think that there is a collective power that you can harness.
Your poetry reads very much like spoken speech, but of a very unusual kind. It's sort of news from the street. That's the sense of it.
Yeah. And look, I absolutely love music that does that, music from the street. And I think Derek Walcott in an interview, he actually said, you know, rappers have got it right. They're actually using meter very effectively. They're using imagery. They're forming, you know, Creole language, yet we don't give them any academic kudos. So part of my mission is to actually blur that boundary, I suppose. I am more comfortable through basically middle-class education myself to get into this field, although as a child I had aspirations to be a rapper. And I loved the idea of freestyle. And something about that spontaneous consciousness, things that well up, things that you absorb, and then being able to creatively just take off with things was something that was very attractive to me.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, we've spoken with Goulburn-based poet Andrew Kwabena Moss about his life and work.
Where do you know me from? Where do you know? Hey, I'm going to laugh.
The Rhyming Bugle. Coming to Jeff's Poetry at Smith's Alternative on Monday, April 3 at 7 p.m, Canberra poet K.A. Nelson, whose new collection from Recent Work Press is forthcoming, and Yelena Dinic, whose poetry and short stories in English and Serbian have been widely published. The University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize is running again in 2023. Entries are now open until June 30. The prize is administered by the university's Centre for Creative and Cultural Research. The winner will receive $15,000, the runner-up $5,000. Search online for University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize. That deadline again is June 30. Another poetry prize currently accepting entries is the Cloncurry Prize, named for that Western Queensland town. Its 2023 theme is Outback Heroes. It has a prize of $10,000. Entries close May 1. For details, search online for Cloncurry Prize Poetry Competition. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of ArtSound FM. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Special thanks to Annika Grant. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Stormzy's 2015 release, Know Me From. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.